Okay, it's 5 o'clock and we want to start on time. So we welcome you to session 173, titled Overcoming the Anger, How to Let Go and Move On. Presenter is John Larson. Before we begin, we ask that your cell phones are turned off, and we hope those attending will be respectful and attentive. The session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor, and I think even later through the Sunstone website. This presentation, a really quick summary of it, is when individuals leave the church, they are often overwhelmed with negative emotions, anger, betrayal, hurt, loss, and loneliness, to name a few. While righteous indignation can seem cathartic at first, hosting negative feelings can begin to feel burdensome. Based on his many years working with individuals in faith transitions, and I think many of you like me have heard him on lots of his podcasts, has been very helpful. John will discuss ways to move on from the pain and embrace more peace and joy. John Larson is the host of the Sunstone podcast and the former host of the Mormon Expression podcast. If you'll join me in welcoming John, that would be great. Thanks.
Thank you. There was a 19th century professor.
I forgot to just tell you. He's welcoming questions during his presentation, which is a little different from others. But he asks that you come to the microphone so that the question is recorded. So feel free to interrupt him like I just did.
Yeah, please. If you got anything to add, jump in. Anyway, Spooner was his professor. I can't remember what he was a professor of. I think like Latin or, you know, like whatever they do at Eton, you know, that sort of thing. And he has a particular verbal tic named after him called a Spoonerism. Our minds are crazy things. And one thing that's crazy is we store the first consonant of a word in a different place in our mind than we store the rest of the word. And you've probably noticed this before when you've said something wrong. But a Spoonerism is when you reverse two of them, like saying what's a famous one? Our queer old dean instead of saying our dear old queen. So, but as Spooner was his professor, he started packing the halls when he ever gave lectures because he apparently would do this all the time. So he started getting angry because he didn't really know if people were there to hear him or just hear him flub up. So I oftentimes wonder if people really want to hear what I have to say or just hear what outrageous thing I'm going to say. So those are my Spoonerisms. I may not be the best person to give this talk. I have anger issues. Now, when I say that, I'm not violent. So I've never hit anybody or I've never done anything like that. But I've dealt with a lot of anger in my life, especially in relationship to this space. And last year, I approached Lindsay about this time. And one of the things that we had done with Whitefields is we had set up kind of an avenue to find therapists who were versed in issues of religious transition and put them out there so that the folks who wanted to talk to a therapist about that could find the therapist who knew what they were talking about. Because it's really a unique set of issues, and not all therapists are versed in speaking to that. They might be, you know, a sympathetic ear and know the standard tool set. So we put this together. So I went to Lindsay and said, that was good work. Let's do it some more. And she said, I have a different idea for you that we want to launch these podcasts. So I agreed. And I came back on in January, and we started doing the Sunstone podcast. If you've listened to my old podcast versus the new, the tone and tenor is quite different because my approach is quite different. But we want to continue that work because Mormons have an aversion to therapy. It's kind of put into them from the time they're young. And so she asked me to come on and do this, and I thought, okay, well, we can do the same thing. But what I've realized is that coming back into this world, I took about 4 years off. I left the Mormon space entirely for about 4 years. And I left Facebook for 2 years. So I came back into Facebook in February. It's only going to last for about another 30 days. And then I came back here, and I'm dealing with anger again. and I'm dealing with depression again. I'm dealing with the issues of this. So I want you to know that I'm sort of saying, here's what I've seen, here's what I've done, but I'm not preaching to you from the pulpit. That this is an active, ongoing thing for me and for most of us who react this sort of way. There's some who are fortunate enough not to have this sort of reaction. But we're going to talk a little bit about anger specifically as a response to a faith transition. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you transition out of the church. You might just change your faith. You might do a lot of things. But for many of us, anger is there. And there's a lot to be angry about. What are you guys angry about in this context?
Authority.
Authority, yeah.
Missed experiences.
You didn't get to do what you would have done otherwise. There's another. Unkept promises. Yeah.
Withheld information, not giving me the respect to think that I might be able to process through real, hit an unscrubbed history.
Treating you like a child.
Yes.
Yeah. The hypocrisy. Right, they would use things that we needed in the religious service, like baptisms and weddings, as a way to control or get us to behave a certain way. We can keep going. Let's hear more.
I think that's what she said, institutionalized sexism.
Institutionalized sexism, yeah.
Institutionalized like injustice and cruelty.
Institutionalized cruelty, injustice, yep. And go ahead. Sex shaming, yep, yep. Broken relationships, keep going.
Brainwashing and control.
Controlled education, not giving full information, for sure, in the back. All the money we pay to tithing. Geez, you start adding that. I have a check at home. It's and I'm going to frame it at some point. It's the fall I was at BYU. I was a starving student. I was working my tail off, student loans, just trying to get through. And I have a $250 check to the church I could not afford. And, you know, that meant that I didn't get good nutrition. It meant that I didn't go out on any dates. It meant that the normal experiences of my college were not there because I, as a starving student, was writing these checks for way too much money. Yeah, it's going to make you angry. Among other things, you should come on the tour of Salt Lake City tomorrow and you can see all the stuff you were building. It's not just a mall. Okay, so we have good reason to be angry. Your anger is valid. I want to state that up front, that there are the people who will shame you for your anger, and we'll talk about that a little bit more, and you will feel shame. And as a matter of fact, in a queer sort of way, you're going to feel angry for being angry. Especially when it's not going away as quickly as you want it to. Mormonism is rooted very deep in our souls. We have in our backyard. Our yard is kind of glorious, and most of it is from people who came before us. But we have a lot of mature trees and ivy and other stuff we have to trim back all the time. But there's these fences in the back of the yard that these plants have grown up through, and now they have very thick stalks. And I cannot remove them without losing the fence, nor can I remove the fence without removing the branches. Some of these plants I don't want to grow in that yard anymore, but they are there. They're part of the fence. They're part of the barrier. My only choice in this weird extended metaphor is to tear down the whole fence and build it up again. But in my weird metaphor, we're the fence. You tear the fence down, you lose yourself, right? But some of these things I have to actively go prune. I have to actively go and cut the stuff because I don't want it to grow anymore. But that big stalk, that big root branch, and if I do that long enough, it'll eventually die. But that'll take sometimes 20, 30 years, really, of pruning that thing back to try to keep it there. But I cannot remove it. And I think for those of us who grew up in the church significantly, made it into adulthood before we had a faith transition, there is a sweet spot. And it's between about 30 and 55, in my experience. If you have your faith crisis, now this is not everybody. If you have your faith crisis after 55, generally, then there's this inverse happiness curve. Have you guys all seen this? Like, you bottom out at about 42. Like, 42 is like the least happy age. And then you start getting beyond 50, and happiness starts going up and up and up to where those older than 55, you generally report it's the happiest time of their life, that doesn't seem like it should be. We all think we're happiest when we're 22, you know, we have abs or whatever. But we all have abs, but some of them are well protected. So Mormonism is the sweet spot. If you leave before about 30, you can process out. You can become like a non-Mormon. But if you leave in that adult thing, it just never quite leaves. It's there. It's like in Tolkien's book, the ring bearers. They never fully recover from carrying that ring around. And they're going to carry it with them the rest of their life. One of the keys is accepting that that's the way it is. And anger and other feelings come because we don't want reality to be what reality is. And what people crave is they want the time back that they lost. They want, you know, they want the relationships they weren't able to have. And you just can't get them back. All right, let's go back and talk about what anger is a little bit. Because it's such a key emotion in all this. And part of the problem is in our culture, we see anger as a character flaw. And part of that is because anger is there to compel us to action in an evolutionary perspective. So when somebody's angry, they're a little bit dangerous. In fact, they might be a lot dangerous. And it's an evolutionary thing for that. But unresolved anger, as you all know, we've been around this world, can lead to violence, can lead to depression, can lead to outrage, and can lead to despair. And anger can be a poison and can lead to a lot of negative things that we'll talk about in a little bit. Carrying these feelings, anger can compel us to basically irrational action. If you think about times when you've been in serious arguments or serious fights with a significant other, with a family member, or even with a stranger, when you cross that threshold into anger, you stop thinking correctly. And matter of fact, that's part of the evolutionary drive for it. And we're going to talk about what happens during that. But every one of you can think of a time that you became angry and you said something or did something that you regret to this day. And so on the one hand, it can lead us to irrational feelings. On the other hand, it can also lead us to feel isolated, depressed, and alone. Because when you're encountering things that make you angry, one of the responses is to pull back. Anger, among other things we'll talk about, can give you an adrenaline hit. And that can be sort of addictive. But when you have a big adrenaline hit, probably most of you are old enough that sometime in your life you've had a big one, like been in a car crash or something like that. You'll know that afterwards, if you have a big adrenaline hit, you'll actually start to shake as you come down from that particular hormone. So you have all these things going on in your body. The heart rate increases, arterial tension comes up, testosterone starts to produce, whether you're a man or a woman. Cortisone, the stress hormone, actually reduces. And that's a key. Because that's one of the things that's pushing us to anger. Oftentimes, if you think about the cycle, when you're dealing with issues like with the church, at first you'll feel stressed, and then sometimes that stress just pushes right into anger. And that reduces, so from a psychological perspective, your body is doing a response that reduces stress. And you're trading one thing for another. You're going into anger. What's fascinating is the left hemisphere, activity in the left hemisphere of the brain increases when you get angry. And when you're kind of in a peaceful state, the right side of the brain will increase activity. There's some really interesting things about this, because when the left side of the brain is activated, it's normally activated in a sense of closeness, intimacy. If you get sexually turned on, if you're talking to a friend, you feel a strong connection, that same left side of the brain lights up. And what that does for us, it promotes you to closeness. So anger is this strange emotion, and all emotions are function on their own because it reads like intimacy, where you have kind of that fight or flight syndrome, and the anger pushes you to fight by pushing you to become closer, to become more intimate with whoever it is you're fighting. So it drives you to engage with the subject of your anger. So most negative emotions like sadness and whatever prompt you to step back. And that's why we tend to bundle all the positive things on the one side and the negative things on the other. But anger sits in this funky place where it acts a lot like it lowers stress, it gives you a jolt of energy, it makes you engage closer to a person. And I don't mean to be crude, but you've all heard about like makeup, sex sort of thing, that those sort of things pushing through your brain can lead to those same feelings. As a matter of fact, it's an old actor's trick, which is if you want to mimic passion on the stage, you don't like your co-actor, you don't have to act passionately, you just have to act like you hate them. And it reads exactly the same. It reads as this intense emotion. Does anger unite people? Yeah, for sure. So anger makes you want to get closer. As you become angry, your body's muscles tense up. Inside your brain, neurotransmitters, known as some Latin-y word that I can't pronounce, and you experience a burst of energy that lasts for a few minutes. This burst of energy is behind the common angry desire to take immediate protective action. It's the flight or fight. And we're going to talk in just a second about why that is. Your attention narrows down, and you become locked onto the target of your anger. And if you've ever experienced something like this, passion works the same way. Your vision will literally start to kind of dim. You can only see what you're about to engage. Because remember, from an evolutionary perspective, you're getting ready to fight. You're getting ready to possibly die. We seldom encounter in our society those situations where your life is on the line, but our evolutionary ancestors did. And anger was one of those particular things. Okay, I want to talk about what's called the recalibration theory of anger. In computational evolutionary theory, in evolutionary theory biology, this is sort of the leading theory about why we get angry and how we get angry, what it does to us. So computational evolutionary model maintains that the function of anger is to recalibrate individuals who place insufficient weight on the welfare of the angry individual. Jeez, what does that mean? And they talk about something called the WTR, the welfare trade-off ratio. So what happens is human beings, we are social animals, and we are unable to survive in the wild on our own. So we had to evolve these cooperative social mechanisms to interact with one another, which involved trade, right? You go out and you kill a fox, and I just mashed up some corn, and we say, all right, well, let's trade this thing back and forth. But the problem is human beings are half cooperative, and we're half really selfish jerks. And that's in both of us. So we had to evolve like these evolutionary elements to keep from getting ripped off. One of my favorite stories that I tell all the time is you'll see in chimpanzees where they have a very hierarchy order. You know, different ones of our relatives have different approaches. You know, the bonobos are very like egalitarian, but the chimpanzees are hierarchical. When the alpha exercises his authority, what happens is the entire troop of monkeys, both men and women, will race up the trees. They'll get away from the alpha, and they'll start doing a howl, a particular howl. And the scientists who study this thing say that howl means bad, no good. So the alpha extracts a cost every time the alpha exercises power. The rest of the entire troop starts to howl. One of the oldest petroglyphs that we have is a picture of a body laying on the ground with 14 spears coming out of the body and 14 other individuals around. In what's theorized by evolutionary biologists is that in our early evolutionary stages, one of the ways we kept alpha males who could be violent and could extract that cost on the troop, on the tribe, is that when they would step over their bounds, the rest of the men would just kill them. So, and you've all, every man in here has experienced that thought at some time in their life. That's something that is deep, guttural in you, where somebody does something and you think that they're out of the pale, and you're like, let's get this guy. And it happens. If you went to junior high, you probably saw some dude on the floor sometime getting kicked, right? It's deep in our DNA. And this theory, the recalibration theory of anger, suggests that if you're giving me a bum deal, you might be more powerful than me, you might be stronger than me, but I am going to emotionally react. And that emotional reaction is anger. That's how we experience that sort of drive. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to extract a cost on you for trying to cheat me, for trying to treat me bad. Because you may be a stronger monkey than I am, but if you try to take my fruit from me and I explode and I hit you, I mean, you might be able to kick the crap out of me, but you're going to think twice about doing that again because there's a cost incurred. And this goes to the group element we were just talking about a second ago. And if there's three of us together, you're dead because no one single male can outpower three other males. So this has a cultural or a cohesion in terms of those who are being picked on. And it really is about balancing the scale according to this theory. So that the bullies can't get away with bullying. Now that works really well when you live right next to the bully in a hut. And that you can kick him in the shin. It starts getting a problem as the bullies get further and further and further away from us. You might get angry, for example, at Republicans and Democrats, but you probably don't experience the same level of emotional response to dictators who are on the other side of the world. So whatever side of the political band you are right now, we've all taken sides, right? We're all dividing up. Probably the other side pisses you off regularly. Even though there might be dictators way on the other side of the world who are doing much worse things to humanity. Terrible, awful, awful things. But you probably don't have the same response to, say, Putin as you did to Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. Because these are people that are inside your space, or your at least your mental space. So that anger is a driving factor of your connection to them. You might get annoyed at people who are, you know, if you read history and you read about Alexander, like, killing all these people, or Napoleon, you probably don't get mad at Napoleon as you do the people who you perceive are giving you that recalibration problem. They're not giving you what you evolutionarily expect. They're not engaged in a fair trade. They're exercising their power in a way that you think is unjust. In the ex-Mormon movement, it has trouble moving out of baser responses because it's based on an inverse predication. Ex-Mormonism is based on Mormonism. There is no unifying factor for ex-Mormons other than Mormonism, right? So, yes, ma'am.
And then at the same time,
can you come up to the microphone, please, young lady?
And then at the same time as you were describing the brain's response to anger, that's addictive. All of those brain responses are addictive responses.
Yeah.
We usually equate them with something that feels pleasurable, but it's all the same side of the brain. It's all the same synapses.
Right. You keep going in. And part of the problem is you're trying to resolve something. And that's kind of – I've set the deck here saying when you have an anger response, it's because you have an unfair trade kind of going on. Something's happening to you that is unjust. And in evolutionary theory, we try to resolve that. Oh, Kimmy's my wife. I'm sorry. Well, maybe you asked me nicely. Okay. Ex-Mormonism is based on this particular response, and it starts to derive its entire identity in victimhood. The problem with that is you were set up to do that from the beginning. The church is bad at a lot of things, and it's good at a few things. It's really good at collecting money. It's derived a program that brings in capital like nothing. You know, so that's one of its surviving powers. It has the power of capital. Go look at the Curtin McConkie building that's sitting right there connected to the temple via a tunnel. It's big, and it's full of a lot of aggressive attorneys. And there's a reason for it. That's part of their model. But another part of their model is if you are an ex-Mormon, they want you to be angry. And they've been working hard at that since 1834, at least. That's when the first big anti-Mormon book was published. So there is a narrative that they have delivered to you all since you were tiny. And if we did an exercise, we could name off all the terms that they have for people who leave the church, for people who turn their back on the tribe. You are an apostate. You're an abomination. You're all these terrible things. You're a son of perdition. You're going to outer darkness. You have all your weddings dissolved, your ceilings to your children dissolved. You have everything taken away from you. And part of that, in my belief, is a response that's conditioned to make you get angry. I used to debate in high school. And one of the best things that can happen if you are in a formal debate is to get your opponent angry. This is something that Donald Trump knows very, very well. Because angry people do not think straight. If I am debating you and you start showing me you're angry, I've won. I've got you. Because I can start leading you around by your nose ring. Because these things we're talking about, their focus narrows on the thing that made them angry. And what Trump does very well, and I'm just saying, not trying to criticize the man necessarily, just saying this is his methodology, is he has learned to play the American press. So that he gets them to react, because they're reacting in a way that is sort of scripted and predicated. He knows what road they're going to go down. And because they're angry, one of the first things they want to do is to deal with that particular anger. And collectively, we all start myopically, like, focusing in on this little thing that he's talking about and ignoring these other things that are going on. And you know, like he said it's been proven that tariffs are all the tariffs being paid by the Chinese. Well, it hasn't been proven at all. The opposite has been proven, right? But then he gets people like me who are in a talk like 4 hours later talking about that, right? He's controlling the narrative because he knows that he's dealing with angry people. We do not like being around angry people. They're not pleasant. They're usually banging one note on the piano all the time. And we saw that there's an evolutionary response that it kind of explains that, because it's that fight or flight. You're supposed to be getting yourself really ready for that particular interaction. So whenever war rhetoric begins to ramp up, if you study history, as we start getting ready for war, what will happen is the aggressors and defenders will start to couch all their experience as victims. To be a victim is a transactional sort of thing. We've couched anger in this transactional framework to say you're angry because there's supposed to be this transaction. You're getting cheated. You're getting mistreated. There's an expectation. That's why I went back to my dictator. There's no expectation that I have from Putin at all. Like, I don't think he's going to give me anything. There's an expectation I have for my president. There's an expectation I have for my church, for my family. So they can fail that expectation and get an emotional response in me. So you've got these elements that are coming together in a very controlled way, that the church wants you to be angry. It knows, and when I say the church wants you to, I should get an asterisk. I think these things just evolved. I don't think there is somebody in the basement pulling the string saying, how do we keep the apostates pissed off? I don't think that ever happened. They just learned effectively that if the apostate came and was saying something very angry, let's take William McClellan. He was, you know, a member of the 12. Of that first party of 12, and he, like Oliver Cowdery and some of these others, when they saw Joseph Smith was doing things that he was preaching against, for Oliver Cowdery, it was Fanny Alger. He saw the affair with Fanny, and he was upset about that, right? Well, William McClellan went to starting to write things, to getting meetings, until he was one of the guys, the Tarred and Feathered Joseph Smith and Kirtland. And matter of fact, he bragged at the time that he clawed Joseph Smith. So he, if you read his journals, he's a fascinating guy. He was one of the smartest early in the quorum. He was a big defender of Smith and helped roll things along. But he got angry because he felt cheated. He felt lied to, which led him to irrational decisions. Because what does tarring and feathering Joseph Smith do? It makes him a victim. In 190 years, we're still telling that story as proof evidence that he is a prophet. So William McClellan gave the church a gift at much pain to Joseph Smith. I mean, no one should have to suffer that. It's terrible. But by forcing him into that action, he did stupid things. And if any of you have been ex-Mormons or progressive Mormons, whatever, for long enough, you've done some stupid things. You've said some stupid things. Things that you wish you could say differently. Not that you weren't right. Not that your feelings weren't true. But your approach was off. And oftentimes that approach is off because it's fueled by anger. And anger is crazy. I have to admit, I'm really disappointed with our society right now. I feel really disconnected. And I've seen that on personal basis. You know, I've been involved in like ex-Mormonism and this stuff for a lot of years. And I can tell you from my personal experience, if I post something critical of the church versus something positive, and I've tried really hard, the response ratio is about 200 to 1 in my experience. So you know, if you posted something that was really critical of the church, you might get 1,000 likes. And if you posted something that was equivalently positive about something, you might get 5. I've been watching this for a lot of years. It's absolutely true. Because we're funneled and we're fueled by this anger. And so since it's baked into who we are, I mean, why do ex-Mormons get angry? Well, you were cheated. You were lied to. And you were mistreated in ways that are hellacious. I always wonder what stories to tell and which ones not to tell. Because I don't want to fuel the fire. I don't want to fuel the ongoing fight. But you'll know that there's a level of hypocrisy that comes about. That's why it's hard to read the news for either party. Because they like attack each other for the same things that they're all doing. But this sort of angry response allows us to get into that. So let's talk about catharsis. Catharsis is the idea that you can get it out. I need to go to the ex-Mormon Reddit. I need to go to the recovery boards. I need to go and I just need to get this out of my system. Well, there's been a lot of research done in this lately. About 20 years ago, if you went to some therapist, they might have you do things like punch pillows or scream into the couch. And they would do this in marriage and family stuff. But there was research doing that venting through such actions actually increases the anger and rage. And they've done some experiments where they have somebody do a catharsis sort of activity versus just sitting quietly, and then they do another activity. One of the studies I read, they were like popping people with air puffs, like that annoyed them. And the people who did the cathartic thing would put more air into it. They would pump and they would hit them harder with air. It would be fun to drive these experiments, I suppose. So this research actually found out the best thing to do was to just sit quietly for 2 minutes. If you were getting pissed off, you were feeling angry, just do nothing. Just stop and do nothing, as opposed to these venting and coping strategies. Okay. I've got extra pages here. I'm trying to figure out what order they go in. Okay, we're on track. Okay, so anger is something that is baked into this identity, this uniting identity of people who are against the church. And it's something the church has sort of pushed you into. It wants you to be angry. Because the narrative is, well, ex-Mormons are angry. And we see this all the time with race or gender relations. I was listening to a story on NPR actually coming from work to here. And they were talking about the pay gap. You know, the women make 80 cents on the dollar. And they say one of the big issues from that is employers often demand your salary history. So a woman will take that first job. And then what employers do is they want to incrementally, you know, give you $3,000 or $5,000 more. So institutionally, this thing gets baked in where everybody who's participating in that system, which is a bigoted system, a gender biased system, but they will all believe that they're not participating in it, right? These HR departments say, well, we're just trying to pay this person what they're worth, not recognizing that a career woman who spent 20 years guaranteed started out lower. She guaranteed to be on this, but they're like, we paid her $5,000 more just like we did the dudes. We are fair. We are safe. We're not bigoted. We do the same thing. I mean, she's another example with black males. They get thrown in prison for long periods of time for things that you and I have done. I would dare say that every one of you has done something that a black man is doing a prison sentence, not a jail sentence, a prison sentence for. Okay? Jaywalking. Go look it up. There are guys sitting in federal prison for jaywalking. Not white guys, black guys. Well, what happens when you get out of jail? I won't ask. I don't want to embarrass you. But you guys who are employers, do you ask, has anybody ever been convicted of a misdemeanor or felony? Probably. And what do you do if they've been convicted of a felony? You throw their resume in a trash can. So you have this system where you take these black men and you do over-aggressive law enforcement. And not only that, just bullying. And the great thing with the phones now is this is getting exposed. Because they were telling us this for hundreds of years, and we didn't believe them. We said, we are a country of opportunity. You can go to Baylor University just like anybody else can. Why do you guys not do it? You don't have to go sell drugs on the street corner. But once you start taking away opportunity after opportunity after opportunity, you start narrowing these people down. And it was a revelation I had about a year ago where you know, because I said the same stupid thing that so many other white people have said. Why do they have to be so angry? If they just came and like were nice, and then I realized if I was treated like black men in America were treated, I would be angry. And because I'm a white man, if that suddenly happened, I would take action, right? So we've created a system where we're funneling these guys into an angry reaction. Most of them don't have a chance. If they came from poverty, you can look at the statistics. Most of us do not really move very far from what our parents made. We move up a little bit. We move down a little bit. But statistically, the majority of you are going to be where you were raised. That's the class you are going to be in. And we understand that, but we fail to see it. So when we take apostates and they're struggling, and you'll know if you've been through this cycle, at some point you start talking to people and you start getting shamed and you start getting isolated and you get released from callings, if you're lucky, and you get disinvited from weddings. But this becomes this perilous thing. Having lived through it for 16, 17 years now, then you're not at their wedding. There's family photos that you're not in. So then you don't get invited to the next thing. And they're like, well, why doesn't John come around anymore? Well, you know, why is he not participating with the family? There's a particular insidious thing that happens here in this anger thing, which is this hypocrisy, which you have a church that sends out 50,000 missionaries a year. What are the missionaries doing? Their job is to get them to abandon their old religion and their old way of life and jump into a new one. And what's really shameful about it is in the church, actually, we don't treat converts the same way as we treat regular members. There's a hierarchy. And the top of the hierarchy, you guys probably aren't in. You don't have the right names. So there's this hierarchy. That's nothing different than every other society, right? We Mormons aren't unique on this front. But we send people, we do these actions. We bear our testimony to them. But you don't bear your testimony really to people who share the same testimony, unless you're in a structured environment. You do that to people who you are aggressively questioning their foundational belief system. You are aggressively saying, I have the truth and you don't. But they've been indoctrinated so much that this is why you can't blame the individual for doing this. They don't see that. But you can see it as an ex-Mormon when they will tell you their belief system, and you will, as gently as you can, most of us try to do this as peacefully, and we consider every word carefully, right? But you're even expressing your own beliefs or your doubt is seen as an act of hostility. And there's that old Adam Sandler movie, Anger Management. I don't know if you've seen it, where they kind of railroad him. Everyone keeps saying to him, why are you so angry? He's not being angry. But the same thing happens oftentimes when you leave the church. It's like you're going to be an angry apostate. And actually, all paths. If you leave the church and then you are happy and have success, you're going to be characterized as somebody who you just didn't care. You didn't care about these things. You're pursuing the worldly. If you leave the church and you run into any problems in your life, let's say 30 years later you get cancer, well, you stop paying his tithing, right? So you get stuck in these places where even normal rational response is seen as anger. So you tend to get angry because we go back to things I was talking about. That biological response is you are getting mistreated. And there's a psychological element here that wants to mistreat you to put you in anger. They're trumping you. And it is an age-old methodology. So you're stuck in this system where you can't get out. And that anger fuels. And it drives you to consume more and more and more. Because you're trying to resolve this problem that you have, of this disproportionate power with institution. The problem is, and here we get to the rub, the Mormon Church is an institution, it's not a person. And these institutional things go beyond any one of the individuals there. It is a mass movement that you cannot really attribute to any one person. Joseph Smith did not design the church we have today. Brigham Young did not design the church we have today. And most of them, if you listen, read between the lines and read carefully in their biography, they feel powerless. There's a great biography of Kimball that his son wrote in 78. They've written one since, and I haven't read that one. But there's an element in there where Kimball talks about becoming after he gets ordained to the 12, that he has zero time. And he's like, I have to prepare all these talks, and I have absolutely no time to think, no time to pray, no time to go become a scholar. There are no more scholars in the 12. The last one was Boyd K. Packer, and he died. There aren't any of them left because they're not selected that way. So you can't really blame them for the doctrinal problem. Who's calling the doctrinal shots? It's clear nobody is, right? It's going like this. So you want to be angry at this institution. But there ain't nobody to be angry at. It is an institution. It has no feelings. This evolutionary response to be angry at the church is completely vacuous because there's nobody to settle the score with. So what does that do to you? If we were all Zen Buddhists, we would just laugh and say, well, that's the funny thing of life. We'll all be dead in 30 years. Let's go have some tea. But we're not Zen Buddhists. We're Mormons. So we want to resolve it. We want justice. And what I think is funny from my standpoint, having kind of passed through the ex-Mormon phase, is you can see ex-Mormons behaving exactly as Mormons do. Because that's the way we've been programmed. That's the way we grew up. That's that branch that grew up in our fence that is deep inside of us, that drives us towards that. But it is hollow. And in my view, anger is a poison. And we talked about it specifically being a poison. Adrenaline is a poison. You can get addicted to it. You can pursue more and more of it. But it's not a really healthy thing. It was not. We were not evolved to be like jacked up on adrenaline all the time. And I think we look at the younger generations, the centennials and the millennials, especially the younger millennials, and we say, why are these guys all anxious? Why are they all killing themselves? Why is this happening? Well, they're in a world where they're constantly having all these things. You can't escape anymore. Like they cannot get away from their social network. And as an ex-Mormon, you're in the same boat. Unless you abandon your family, you abandon your job, your relationships, and you start watching these things turn. I've experienced, many other people have, that the word gets out that you've left the church. This is years ago for me, and coworkers stop talking to you. They won't travel with you. And suddenly you see your career start to dim. That's going to get people angry. And you take an extension by society now. Unfortunately, this is not a Mormon problem I'm talking about. The AIs that places like Facebook and that run do one thing and one thing only. They try to get as much engagement as they possibly can. They want you to keep clicking back. They want you to keep buying things. They don't really care about your mental health, these AIs. There might be leaders of these organizations who do, maybe, I don't know. But these things just want you to click as much as possible. And what we've learned is the currency of clicking, the currency of engagement, is outrage. The year and a half after Trump won the election, I've always been a big consumer of the news. I've read a lot. That just went into hyperspeed. I was just reading newspaper after newspaper after newspaper because it was outrage. It was anger. And I was trying to resolve, my evolutionary biology was trying to resolve that anger. And it couldn't do it. There was no resolution because I don't have a partner that I can punch in the face. I don't have a way to resolve it. And as an ex-Mormon, you think you have a way to get back at the church. You think you have a way to resolve this. And every so once in a while, somebody breaks through and makes a dent. But the fact is, most of us don't. And that leads to even more anger because you're in this situation that you cannot get out of directly. All right, did we paint a bleak picture?
Yes.
All right, the whole thing's on coping strategies. And one of them for me was fatigue. Like when it came to the politics, I just wore myself out. I like a 4-year-old, you know, just throwing a tantrum on the floor, which is exactly what I was doing. I just don't kick my legs. I read the New York Times. Okay, so coping strategies. I have 12 of them, and I want you to think about some of the ones that you've had, and please come up if you have things to add. First is therapy in groups. But you have to be careful. You do not want groups that compound that anger. And a lot of these Facebook groups or other groups that you can get involved in will become an outlet for this sort of thing. And what most of us have this kind of devil's choice because we want to be in that group. We see things that help us process. We see things that we connect to. We find out we're not alone. These are all psychologically positive things. But there is this wave of outrage that's hitting you all the time, that's pulling you back in, that's unresolved. Because the case that I made here is this is a biological response that is unresolvable because you don't have a partner to resolve it with. You can't ever balance the equation. So every time you get angry, there's nowhere for the anger to dissipate to. There's no way to get rid of it. And especially if you go back into these groups, you start hitting that again and again and again. And I would suggest even talk therapy. There's research now suggesting that plain old talk therapy, like Freud used to do, and they used to do a lot in the 80s and 90s, where you lay on the couch and just kind of free-form talk, and they would keep that it itself can lead to unresolved consequences. There's some research. You've probably all heard Ira Glass, the guy who does This American Life. His mother was actually a sex researcher. And she did research on why people cheated, why they really cheated. But where it ended up being is she came to the conclusion, wrote some papers on this, that people oftentimes cheat because they like sex. No, it's a good question. But what would happen if you went to your therapist, you and your spouse, one of you cheated, and you go to your therapist and say, he cheated on me. What's the therapist likely to do? Well, according to her research is, they will start rooting around in both of your psychologies till they find a problem that caused you to cheat. Rather than look at the obvious thing, when I look at the statistics, say 50 to 75% of people cheat, that means we're horny, right? We're these animals that really like to have sex. And you talk to people, and don't get me wrong, I know that adultery and cheating can be one of the most painful things people experience. I'm not trying to undermine that pain. But what happens in therapy, and you've seen this, is they go in and they're like, why did you cheat? I don't know. Well, why did you do it? She looked good? She was willing? I mean, that's probably more likely the right answer. I had an opportunity. You know, like, women don't pay any attention to me. I was on the road. There was this woman there, and we were drunk, and we had sex. But what they oftentimes want to do is they want to find out that root cause. What's wrong in your relationship? You clearly don't love me because you cheated on me. And what her research showed is that that thing that we told ourselves wasn't really true. So I'm going back to this talk therapy. Sometimes rooting around for a problem to find out why you're angry is the wrong thing to do. You're angry because you're angry. It's a biological response to some of the things we talked about. But if you try to find this root cause, say, well, you know, I told my mom that I no longer believed, and then she gave me this cold shoulder. She won't invite me to Christmas parties anymore. Why is she doing that? What's the reason? What went wrong with us? Why does she not love me as a child? Why can she not pay attention to the beliefs that, by my mom's really great. I'm just in the abstract. Why, you know, all these things, we want to find this cause. We want to solve the problem of our anger. And sometimes the problem is not solvable. You have a big, powerful institution that treated you poorly. They did so because that's a good way to keep people from listening to apostates. That's your answer. They wanted to neutralize your voice so that the members wouldn't listen to it. And Mormonism had a long, long history of people leaving the church. 50, 60% of anybody who's ever joined the church has left. There are more ex-Mormons than there are Mormons. There always have been. Just most ex-Mormons don't give a shit. There's some of us who do. Okay, so therapy and groups, good. But it needs to go on to talking about processing through things with trying to avoid that anger as much as possible. Number two, this is a piece of advice I've probably given to people most often. You need to learn to treat the church and Mormons like strangers. If you went to Tibet and you went into one of those temples, you wouldn't say, look at those hats. These guys are goofy. And red and gold together? What are you guys thinking? Don't you have any sense of style? But what happens when you go into a Mormon church now? Like, carpet on the walls? Why do people put carpet on the walls? Oh, look at this art. You know, it's just, I'm at a dentist's office. You will do that. At least I do. but if you learn to treat the Mormons as you would a different culture, you give them space. We allow strangers to be themselves. We allow them to be quirky. We allow them to be flawed. And if you're a world traveler, you go through and you find that stuff quaint and engaging. All their little cultural quirks, all their funny hats are not something to be ridiculed. But we always like to ridicule our own funny hats. And the more that you can distance yourself and say, Mormons are strangers, the more you will be non-reactive to those things. The next one is very related, but I think it's worth mentioning. Become an anthropologist. Treat Mormonism as a different culture. And start, you know, oh, they do this. Oh, why do they wear funny hats in the temple? Oh, because that was a costume that was used in the Scottish Masonic Rite in the 19th century for the high priests. Oh, well, they're not just making funny hats. They're actually pulling on an ancient tradition. And so you start to change your perception. It's not necessarily that you begin to believe or not believe. You start to see things for the way they are, that this is another American religion that's born. This is another extension of Protestant America. And there's interesting ways that they've solved these problems. And when you start detaching yourself from it, then you can see this is something that's out there. It neutralizes it, Kimmy says, yes. And in a way that we give deference to other things. Okay, number four, avoid those that make you angry or outraged, like it's contagious, because it is. And this is hard because oftentimes the people who get you most angry are the first and best support that you get when you leave the church. Like things I've talked about, oftentimes you are alone and you are isolated and you are confused and you are scared and you are angry. And then you find people who are in that same spot, and suddenly the important part of that is you don't feel crazy anymore. Because that's the whole thing about gaslighting, right? They want you to feel like you're broken, you're defective, you have something wrong with you, and you find these people. But what the proper path is to pull off from those people as quickly as you can. You have to love them at a distance. And this is really hard to do, because oftentimes they are our rebound. Relationship. And if you've been divorced or been in a long-term relationship, you know that rebound relationships are very important and they never work. But they help you work through some stuff, right? And that's what these things are, they're rebound relationships. And the quicker you can move away from that, then the quicker that's going to stop hitting you. Number five. Come on.
So as far as avoiding people that trigger those responses, one of the most difficult things for me, in my, especially big Mormon families, right, is families, family activities. We have, I know in my family, we have a big family property, and, you know, everyone wants to go up on certain holidays, and yet they're going to have family home evening, and they're going to do all these things that are super triggers for us.
Mm-hmm.
I've said the best thing that's helped me is boundaries.
Yes.
And I've explained to the people that are closest to me what I'm doing, why I'm doing it, and that I'm going to take those situations at my own terms. But there's a few things that I always do. One, I always leave myself an out. I always make sure I drive myself. So if we need to go, we can. And leave, if you're starting to experience those triggers, leave earlier than later. Avoid that anger loop before it starts to get you.
I think
that makes sense.
Yeah, I think you're spot on.
Cool.
And I would add two things to those. Go into the kitchen. Keep yourself busy. Go make the Jello. Like when they're doing that, they're talking. Because there is a certain ignorance here, and ignorance is something we're all guilty of. I don't mean that as an insult. That of processing that some of the talk that they have, just the way they talk about the religion, might be somewhat offensive or triggering to people who aren't in that anymore. They don't understand. They don't get it. And it's really hard to get. So I really love everything you said about maintaining the boundaries. And I say, I give you permission to not go. That you can actually say, I'm gonna be out. And what I found with I'm lucky because it's been 16 years for me. So the generation of ex-Mormons that I process through with, they're all kind of where I'm at. They've and good news, this goes away. And good news, this goes away. The anger will go away even if you do nothing. But if you do some of the things that we talk about here, it will accelerate the process of healing. You can't stay outraged. It just doesn't work. And you've seen those people who stay outraged at their ex-wife or ex-husband for years. They have to work at it a lot. You're like, you know, because they're like, he's got a new floozy, and he's in a condo, and he's flying back to New York. How long ago did you guys get divorced? 18 years ago. How do you even know what he's doing? You know, my favorite story on that. I was with a friend, and she told me a story about her dad. He was in a store. He's in Lucky's, like in California. And this woman came up and said, "You look familiar." And he's like, "Yeah, we were married for 18 months about 25 years ago." That story should give you huge amounts of hope. If this reasonable guy can forget that this woman he was married to, then you can forget everything else. But the anger does pull you back in. Yeah, come on up.
I guess with the avoidance thing, one thing I've found myself doing that I'm a bit confused about is I've been out of the church for a couple years, and sometimes I've noticed when I'm with my family and they're still all believing, sometimes they bring up stuff that has been going on recently, like the reversal of the policy change or something like that. And I've been finding myself like wanting to avoid talking about it as sort of like a protection so that I don't work myself up into a very big emotional state, because I feel like I can get into it if I wanted to, but I don't always want to.
And you're right not to want to. And the hard part is oftentimes they'll be talking about something because you're an ex-Mormon. You've read like 700 pages on this particular topic, and you know exactly like what the general authority just said in like a Portland area conference, and like you have this encyclopedic knowledge of everything that's going on in Mormonism right now, and they're talking standard dumbassery, and you want to go in and correct them, right? We'll get to another way of doing that in a second. That's number six. We're still. What I found to add to that with family, here's one thing that I did that was very effective with family and close friends, is when they started talking about religion or their testimony or whatever, I would say this line, and this is a good one. I am happy to talk to you about this, but I'm going to share my beliefs with you. Do you want to have this discussion? I would be happy to have this discussion. I have found that whenever I've said that to people, it ends. Now, that might be somewhat because of my personality. They don't want to deal with, you know, I kind of, if asshole is over here, I kind of skirt that line quite a bit myself. But you can really say it. You say, I would love to talk to you about Joseph Smith, but I'm going to share my feelings about Joseph Smith with you. Are you okay with that? And they'll either change the subject or you've got them in a trap. And the trap is really, let's have a regular conversation. Let's break this anger cycle and let's have this be about you and me. So it's not about the church, because what they're doing is they're saying, you're attacking the mother church, which insults me. They're not seeing that as an engagement with them. Please.
This is going backwards a little bit, but you had said something about, let's start over. I've learned in this session that many of the sessions I choose to go to at Sunstone do that same thing, because they're going through some of the crises that I've gone through, and I get angry again and get emotional. So I need to be more generic in my Sunstone attendance.
That you're right. That anger, and that anger does validate. It feels good in a way. Like I've struggled with low level depression my whole life. It kind of comes and goes for me, and anger for me leads to depression. But there's a part about, if you've ever been depressed, there's a part about it that is attractive in your psychology. It likes it. And for these deep, like emotional pits, anger and depression and outrage, there's something about it that feeds our psychology. And when we're out of it, we can see that pattern. But when you're in it, you want to keep going. It's addiction cycles. It's the same thing with food and drugs and sex and everything else that's enjoyable. You can get stuck in that thing, right? And it's a dilemma. I've spent years, I said I took 4 years off from Mormonism. I actually, every year I've given a talk at Sunstone. And there have been years, not because people mistreat me, but there have been years, honest to God, I would pull into the parking lot 6 minutes before my talk, run straight in. Go ask Lindsay. She'll laugh about this. Run straight in and then run straight out. And it wasn't because I was trying to avoid anybody, but I didn't want to get amped up. I didn't want to get triggered. And that's one of the things I think about Sunstone. If you're going to do it anywhere, do it here. I was going to use a really bad metaphor. But if you're going to do it here, do it here, because this is an organization that has, I was talking to some snufferites out in the hall, and I was talking to three different polygamists out there just right before I got here. There are all sorts of, we're all here. And if there's any place to process through, it is here. So I give you permission to feel a little bit of outrage, but I think that interrogating that and understanding why am I doing this and what's happening is really important. Okay, in business we have what we call root cause analysis, and one of the ways we do that is what's called the five whys. It's really annoying, and your 7-year-olds have done it to you, which is you keep asking the question why. One of the things I get most frustrated with Mormons when I'm talking about theology with them is they'll present some kind of theological answer, or they'll say, "Oh, well, the world's too complicated, so we need God to explain that complexity." And then I always ask the next question: "Well, we need God for this, isn't God more complex than this? Don't you have the same problem?" They never like that. Because a lot of theological things, they have a surface answer. They're just so story, like Rudyard Kipling talked about, and you can't necessarily get to the bottom of it. Where it becomes helpful here is if you keep asking why the church is doing something that's damaging, you will probably arrive at some root cause that is not nearly as aggressive as you think it is. When you start asking, okay, well, the church isolates people, from weddings. Well, why do they do that? Because they're assholes. And then you say, well, why are they assholes about it? And then you start going in, you start saying, well, it's part of the doctrinal thing, that there's a very positive element for a lot of people getting married in the temple, and having that sealing gives their marriage a lot of meaning. And it can only have that meaning by being special. And it can only be special if there's certain hoops you have to jump through. Every organization from the Boy Scouts to Harvard University knows this. There's a reason that military people have all sorts of badges on their uniform. We're motivated by such things. And what you have is almost an unintended consequence. But then the unintended consequence finds that church's own research, it's leaked years ago, that the closer people are to temples, the more likely they are to pay a full tithing. So for the church, building a lot of temples is an investment, right? But do they necessarily see that? They may not. What they might see is we have growth. We have more money. We can build more buildings. And they may not actually make the connection. We're doing that by extracting more money out of people. So keep asking those questions, why? I think one of the ways through anger is to go deeper. It's paradoxical. Go deeper. Start reading what they actually wrote. If you hate Joseph Smith and he pisses you off, read what he actually wrote. Go get the books over there. And really get to know the guy, because you'll see more of that humanity come through. When you see more of that humanity, he's not just a monster. Okay. This is the one that I use a lot. It's related to the five whys. It's number six, which is, and then what? Kimmy will tell you this is how I talk to a lot of people these days and talk to myself. I'm become very much more Buddhist, and I study a lot of Buddhism. And I probably stole this from them, which is, okay, what is it you're trying to do? Well, I'm mad. And I need to tell my family, you know, I need to tell my family the truth. And then what? Well, then they'll listen to it, and they'll understand, and they'll see that I'm right. And then what? Well, hopefully they'll leave the church. Oh, and then what? You know, like my parents in their mid-70s, they're wonderful people. Mormonism is part of them. And they came of age in the golden age of Mormonism, when it was about culture, and it was about connection, it was about community, about family. There's part of me that wants them to embrace the truth. But there's another part of me that's a stronger part of me that does not want to cause them the kind of suffering that I've had. Now, Bob McHugh is, we have short memory. Bob McHugh is a brilliant ex-Mormon philosopher who was writing a lot of stuff in the 90s. Go look him up online, read his essays. He was a bishop, he was an attorney up in Canada. And he wrote, he was one of the first kind of public bishops who came out. And he wrote a lot of good stuff. But he said something that stuck with me. He said, I left the church so that I take the arrows and not my kids. And I think that there's an element that says, if you're leaving the church or you're engaging the church in a different way, that you're in the pews with your rainbow flag on, that you're hanging your flag out on Pride Day for everybody to see, you're able to make changes. You put the flag up, and then what? You're not looking for a fight. You're looking to signal to the others who are struggling. And what we don't want, and what's happening right now, if I compare the ex-Mormon world right now to 10 years ago, I'm panicked because people are coming out of the church too fast. We are overwhelming the old resources. And if the church were to disappear from Salt Lake City tomorrow, we would have a social crisis of amazing proportions. Fundamentalist sects would jump up all over the place. There are people, I've been around ex-Mormons enough to know that most of them, they thrive outside the church. 10, 20% don't. And I've been to their funerals. And we start doing that on large scale. We have 200,000 people leave the church next year, and you have a social crisis in the state of Utah. And so we have to be careful what we actually wish for, because there's a lot of people who are in the church that if it was to fall, the structure was to fall down, they were left without belief, they would go into existential crisis. And that worries me somewhat, that we want to help people process and get to healthy places, whether that's inside the church or outside the church. That's what we want. And sometimes our actions, and I'm pointing at myself here, can be destructive to people's testimony in a way that has a destructive effect on their life. So ask the question, and then what? Because it happens to me all the time. I'm sitting there, and somebody's saying something just dumbass. And when I was in my 20s, I would just blurt out. And I'm starting to learn, and I'm still starting to learn, that the effect is not very good for me. I have to ask myself that question. Okay, these guys are saying this stupid thing that will work for me, let's say. And then I shame them. I make them feel bad. I make them feel dumb. And then what? And that's the problem with this anger. Oftentimes it leads, we want this thing, but we don't think far beyond that thing. It's just, we go back to adultery. That most people don't think past that they're going to score. But they don't go, and then what? And then what? And then what? And then what? Because when you start going down that path, you start realizing, again, I'm going to get very Buddhist, that it's all futile. Most of us, we won't make a big impact on the church. Hell, this, you go look up like Falun Gong or one of these other, see how many members they have. Our church and our experience, which is meaningful to us and meaningful to me and my life, 300 years from now, if Mormonism shows up as a footnote in a history book, I would be surprised. That doesn't mean that our experience isn't valuable and it's not important to us. But when you take the global stage of what Mormonism is and what it means to this country, its impact is small. And if you can remember that, then you realize that these fights are just nonsense. They're just schoolyard-like shenanigans. But we wrap up in so much. Okay, and then what? Number seven, get busy. If you got a phone, you're more likely to engage it when you're bored. And if you're an ex-Mormon, you're going to go to Reddit, you're going to go to Facebook, you're going to go to these places, and you're going to see stuff that is going to piss you off. You're going to go from you have 15 minutes where dinner's on the table to being pissed off in about 60 seconds. And that didn't have to happen. You did that because you were bored. You wanted that dopamine hit you got from the interacting with the phone, and instead you get an adrenaline junkie charge because now you're really pissed off. Learn to do other things. I like to go down and garden when I get really angry because it's hard to maintain my anger when I'm pulling weeds. And that's what works for me. Number eight. This I'm borrowing from Jonathan Haidt, his book, The Happiness Hypothesis, and some of the others I would recommend to anybody. He has a metaphor he talks about that very much in cognitive science, we are not as in control. We are not as, we don't have as much free will as we think we do, basically. But he uses a metaphor that we're like a rider on an elephant. And if that elephant gets pissed off, you are out of control. And if you want to train that elephant, you have to do so very slowly. And if you want to turn the elephant, you have to do it very slowly. Well, in this metaphor that Jonathan Haidt gave us, you are the rider and the elephant. So understand that when you're feeling angry, you have to work for the future. It is very, very difficult to change your emotions in the moment. But you can practice some anger dissipation. Anger dissipation exercises that will pay off the next time. And everybody who's been any kind of addict knows about this, that you're going to hit this thing. And when you resist and you do these things, then it gets this much easier. And it gets this much easier. And it gets this much easier. And if you put that in the bank, you're going to fail. That's the nature of addiction. But instead of getting this much better, then it gets this much better. So you start training yourself little by little to redirect out of the anger. So turning the elephant slowly, recognizing that you're still going to go to a Sunstone talk and you're still going to get pissed off, and that's okay. But that leads to the next one, which is mindfulness and detachment. Again, going to a Buddhist thing, detachment. The ultimate goal of mindful practice, mindful meditation, is that you become aware of your emotions. This is the bottom line. And that your emotions don't control you. There's a misnomer, especially among Westerners studying Eastern philosophy, that when you start approaching nirvana, you stop feeling things. But the practitioners who are really good at this would say, no, you feel everything. You're just aware of it. And there's a little exercise that I learned that I think is really valuable. It's really helped me a lot. Which is when you're feeling a negative emotion, when you're feeling anger, you interrogate, what is it I'm actually feeling? No, like, where am I feeling it? So you start saying, well, I'm feeling it, like, right here. Or I'm feeling it here. Or I'm feeling it here. Like, where in your body are you feeling it? And oftentimes, the effect of that, not always, but the effect of that for me can be, your body now is distracted by thinking about you have a stomach ache, which is now no longer an emotional reaction. You're concentrating on the physical side. Because anytime you have these, we talked about that, you can start shaking, you can turn red. There is a physical response to anger, right? And if you start saying, I'm shaking. Wow, that's amazing. I'm shaking. Look, I didn't choose to shake. How did I get the shakes? Oh my God, I feel it all the way up here. And then you notice you stop shaking. You're like, oh, I'm hungry. I want a sandwich. And then you, it's gone. And it's sometimes actually that simple. But with mindfulness, what you're going to do is you're saying, I'm angry. Why am I angry?
When you're talking about detachment, I think about, I just had this thought. I don't know if it's a good one or not. It's not necessarily detaching from emotion, but maybe detaching that current emotion from future action. Maybe?
Wait, say that again. Detaching from future action?
I'll never be able to detach from the emotions I have, but I can detach this current emotion I have from my action towards the future.
You can try to interrupt this cycle of anger leads to this and leads to this. And the, what did Yoda tell us? Anger leads to hate and hate leads to suffering or something. You ever notice that everything Yoda said is wrong? Go watch the movies again. He's always 100% wrong. So mindfulness and detachment, it is worth the practice. It is hard. I suffer from a couple things. One of them is ADD. And it took me a long time to be able to actually not even just dread meditation. I would absolutely dread it. But one of the things I read from like a Zen master is recognizing, because I thought I would be successful in meditation when I didn't have thoughts and feelings interrupting. But then when I read and I really understood that, no, they're going to interrupt. You just want to be aware that it's happening. You're never going to, the whole idea of that, you need to, you have something that's coming out of you. You need to come up and talk to us.
In the meditation, these thoughts will still continue to come in your head, but you recognize them and then dismiss them and go back to them, you know, the counting or whatever you've decided to concentrate on, and stop being angry at your mind for sending these things to disrupt your meditation, because that's completely fruitless.
Yeah, you're right, because when you start meditating and you start trying to practice mindfulness, you're going to be angry that you're angry. And the Buddhists talk about that you do this because, like, you want to get rid of desire or suffering, you know, which for the Buddhists, those are connected. But wanting to get rid of desire is itself a desire. So it's a paradox. And the only way out of the paradox is to recognize you can't stop yourself from being angry. No one can stop themselves from anger, but you can recognize that it's happening, and then it dissipates, and you can break the chain. You can break the cycle of what happens next, and then the anger is less and less. And it'll come to a point where you'll get something that used to get you angry, now you just look at it as ridiculous. You just kind of laugh it off. It's like, oh, they're saying those stupid things again. Okay, number 10, mind-cooling exercises and refocusing. This is like Stuart Smalley sort of stuff. I'm bright enough. I'm strong enough. In Dune, in Frank Herbert's book, what is the Bene Gesserit prayer? Fear is the mind killer. You have it.
Will not fear, fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death. Total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will allow it to pass over
through
you.
Fear is God.
That's it.
The Buddhists, there's five main avenues of meditation, and one of them is chanting, like Namo Dasa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sampu. You start doing that sort of stuff, and the problem is, or the advantage is, it's really hard to keep track of what it is you were pissed off about when you're reciting these things in your head. So it works. Mind cooling, dissipation, have your own mantra that you say, and you keep saying over and over again. This shows up. I passed through atheism to the other side. I'm no longer an atheist. That doesn't mean I believe in God. I'm just not an atheist anymore. And you'll see these patterns that religions have. Tibetans have prayer beads. Catholics have prayer beads. You see these things happen over and over again because they work, because they're ways to cool the mind. All right. Number 11, don't hurt people. Don't hurt people. It sounds simple. And it's hard, but if the reaction that we have when I talk in this first part of the talk is you want to settle the score. You were wronged. You were cheated, and that cannot last. It destroys our culture. But in these situations where you have this institution, you can't do anything about it. And when you accept that, then you say, okay, I'm mad because President Nielsen said something stupid. So who am I going to take it out on? The first unfortunate poor sap who wanders into my radar. right? And I want to hurt them because I can't hurt them. And if you just try to say, who is this going to hurt? Is my target the right target? And every animal struggles with this. I mean, literally every animal. If you had, like, your dog have a thorn in her paw, she's gonna bite you. But there's kind of a tragic metaphor. If you're a fox and you get caught in a trap, there's only one action that actually might save you. That's to do nothing. Because if you start pulling at it, then you cause more injury. And so a lot of times we get in these traps. The fortunate thing where this metaphor breaks down in a good way is the traps tend to dissipate over time. Like, they open themselves up. But if you can get to that point when the trap comes down and you feel that cortisone going up, you feel that anger rising, and you recognize, I'm going to do nothing. I'm not, because I don't want to hurt anybody, especially myself. Because when I get angry, I come down, I feel stupid. I feel, it makes me feel terrible when I lash out. All right, number 12, and maybe the most important thing, let them come to you. What I mean by that is to enter into this state, and you're all here at Sunstone, so you're all in this. None of you can get out of this. You know more than they do. You understand it better than they do. You were on both sides. You were them. Now you're you. And you're this wealth of information. You can teach them the truth that they say they are so in desire of. You have it. You have the medicine that they need. And so you want to give it to them. You can't. You have to let them come to you. And as a matter of fact, by not playing the game, and the game is in our psychology, the game is in our hardwiring, that you don't get angry, that you can go to a baptism and not get all frustrated. I can do that now, but there were a lot of years I couldn't. Then you're this queer thing they can't understand. I told you in the beginning, the problem with being an apostate in the Mormon church is it's the one thing they're really good at is handling apostates. And it's really hard not to play in their script. And this is where I go back to the trap. Just stop. And some of them will eventually come to you. But not necessarily. You can't necessarily win this fight. They can contextualize whatever happens to you in your life as being proof that you were wrong to leave the church. But by being that stoic person, by being that person that they see, here's a successful, happy person who still sends her nieces and nephews cards at their baptism, they just don't know what to do with you, and you blow their mind. I haven't done that at all. I've tried most of these things, and again, I want to revamp. I still struggle with anger. And you know, I told you, I came back into this world, and it has. I haven't recorded a podcast in 5 weeks. And it's part because I've just been doing self-care. I have to step back. And even though I've been talking to very positive people, I've been talking to people who are doing a lot, that this situation exists is hard. But we're not that special. There are still people who have tattoos on their wrist of the number from the concentration camp. There are genocides going on right now. And we tend to be very myopic in saying, well, it's really bad for us. And we're different than everyone else. And when you realize that these sort of circumstances happen everywhere, that we're not that special, it can kind of help us. But I want you to hear the last thing. This is an ongoing struggle for me. And the best way is for me to just disengage. And all these things are really patterns of disengagement. If you go back and read my list, they're just ways to pull away from it. And move from. Those are some of my strategies. I'm not the best at this. I want to hear the ways that you guys have. What time is it? 6:24. We have 6 minutes, or you can go to dinner. I don't care. So what did I miss? What has worked for you? Please.
I try to use humor.
Humor, yes.
So I wait till there's a lag in the conversation, and then I look at him very earnestly, and I just say, do you think Jesus is going to get mad that the church reversed Revelation and then just shut up. It's a real, it's great.
If they take it as humor.
They will.
Yeah, okay, good. I agree. Yeah. But it is circumstantial. Sometimes things are funny to me that aren't to anybody else. No, I think that's great advice because you're lowering the tension, you know, because like I was saying in the beginning, this whole anger response cycle, and they get angry at you too, is really your evolution of getting up to like kick the shit out of each other, right?
So I had a faith crisis maybe 10 years ago and still hide from my mom because I love her and I don't want to break her heart. And
I decided
the church wasn't healthy for me because Holland had to point that out publicly in a talk in 2015. And I felt like he had knocked me out, like we were boxing or in UFC, and he had me pinned. And he knew it. Anyway, the reason that I don't tell other people, like you said, the number 12 being, let them come to you, is that I view my own life like a book, like Dune, like a story. And it starts with chapter one, and it goes long, and I'm where I am. Or think of it like a movie. Nobody likes spoilers. On the internet, you'll get killed for spoiling some cool movie. And to tell what I make of the church now to other people who haven't finished watching that movie on their own is like a spoiler, and they need to watch it all the way through. And maybe theirs has a happy ending. And if it does, geez, like my movie is a bit of a tragedy. In some regards, an emotional wreck through which I think other people could, if they could live without that all the way through, I'm happy for them. And especially people closest to me, like my mom. But it's like a book or a movie, and I don't want to tell the spoilers. And even if people come to me with information like that, I have to remind myself that to curb the impulse to pile on, because I learned with my own wife when it all came to a head, I tried to deconvert her, and she really would be like, if there was an upside down symposium, oh, it's Education Week, I went with her last, I went with her to show I care last Education Week in September, but that's where her spiritual home is, and my spiritual home is here. And I feel like I did that to her by doing this, like spoiling the whole movie in front of her. And it didn't work anyway, but I really appreciate all the things that you had said.
Thanks. I think it's great advice. And, you know, religion is so personal to us. And we're all on our own journeys, you know. Yes, ma'am.
I'm loud enough. I probably don't need the microphone.
Me too.
So, theater teacher, woo. But, so my husband was one of those aggressive ex-Mormons, and sorry, I also get emotional when I talk about this, but he was not so nice, and it separated us for a long time, and so instead of doing what he had hoped and I would leave and everything, I went, oh, by the way, I'm going to BYU-Idaho. See ya! And I did, but I worked for the airline, so I'd fly to school and then fly home. And So I'm not an ex-Mormon. I'm just inactive, and there were just, because I really feel like if it could change, it would be a better thing. But when my husband was being so aggressive about it, it was like he took the one thing that was keeping me from falling apart away. Sorry. And so I went to counseling, and my counselor was like, one thing that I was struggling with is that when my husband's mom died, we were very, very close. Like, you talk about wonderful mother-in-laws, it doesn't happen very often, and I have an awesome mother-in-law. And I dropped to my knees, and I prayed. I was like, please, don't take her. And, like, that prayer did not get fulfilled after that. I was so angry. And so I had to go to counseling because, like, I was losing my entire, oh, my gosh, I'm so sorry, you guys. I should have taken a Xanax or something before I came up here. But one thing that my counselor was talking to me about is that you can't just ignore it. You can't ignore the feelings that go along with this faith crisis. That you have to imagine yourself like on a subway or in a room, and you can see that looming monster, fear, anxiety, whatever you named it, and then you acknowledge it, and it has this rope, and you're playing tug of war with this rope, right? So you acknowledge it, and then you drop the rope. And so what she would have me do is every time I felt that anxiousness and that, like, you know, like down to your soul, you're like, I'm not right. This isn't right. I don't know what to do. I'm gonna collapse. And you would take it, and you just would literally, like, acknowledge it, and then you would physically just drop your hand, like you're dropping that rope or that chain or that anchor or that whatever those ball things are. You know, they put on pirates to drown them.
A ball and chain?
Yeah, those.
Yeah. Sounds like a bad marriage joke from the 50s.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So just that physical act of, like, and people are like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm stretching. No, you know, and so just getting that physical muscle, whole body thing, just a physical relief. Like, now anytime I get worked up about, like, the afterlife, because I still am just, like, that is the worst thing for me to talk about, because I don't know. Like, do any of us really know? And so just dropping that, acknowledging it, I'm like, I see you, but I'm going to drop that. So there's no struggle, so it has no control over me.
I think that's all brilliant. The afterlife one was one that really bothered me. Every night for probably 2 years when I was falling asleep. And then I recognized at one point that my believing one thing or the other didn't make it true. So I could let it go. I couldn't solve the problem of whether there is an afterlife. And whatever it is, regardless of my belief in it. But it's the same thing that you're saying. It's this really deep realization that I didn't have to believe in something to make it true. It was either true or it was false. And my belief was sort of irrelevant. Sir?
You're out of time. That's good. So I'm really new to this. So I stopped wearing garments.
Welcome
about
to
a
the
year
circus.
And this year I'm a new attendee at Sunstone.
Congratulations.
Next year I'll probably kill a guy. I don't know.
There's a lot of raping that has to happen before you get to that point, I think.
I feel really lucky, and I just want you to know if you're speaking into the void, you're not, because I've listened to some of your new podcasts and stuff, and I really enjoy it. I went back and listened to some of your old ones. They're a little angry.
They're a little rougher, aren't they?
Yeah. You're like
a little more angry.
You're like Howard Stern, you know, he's the new kinder,
yeah.
Howard Stern.
Yeah.
Like Howard Stern of Mormonism, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, thanks.
But I just want to say, I'm lucky. I was born and raised in Salt Lake City. I joined the church at 20. My mother was quite bitter about the church and stuff. And I joined the church to kind of piss her off and stuff, and it worked. But
yeah.
I spent, I went on a mission at 21, and I lived my life in Mormonism, married in the temple, had three children. They all left as teenagers. I was always fine with that. I got a little angry in the last few years because everybody always told me my mother was off a rocker, and then they released these essays, and it was all the things my mother told me. And I'm like, well, you know, and I got kind of mad at that, but I realized that somebody said, and it was one of your podcasts where you said, they didn't set out to piss you off. People that told you that kind of stuff didn't know any different. So I appreciate your podcast because it kind of helps me with anger. I'm lucky because I'm the youngest of four, the only Mormon or ex-Mormon in the group. So my family, I told my one sister that lives in Salt Lake, I'm not going to be a Mormon anymore. She goes, oh, well, who cares, you know.
Uh-huh.
So that's my, so I feel for people that are, well, you know, losing your family and your heart, and you can't go to events with your family and all that stuff. I really feel for you. It's my first day at Sunstone has been a real, real eye opener that way. I guess I just didn't realize how much pain there is in it, and how, you know, Mormons would say I was unlucky to not be a Mormon, but I feel so lucky to have been raised outside of it without all that stuff. But
thank you. I appreciate it.
Keep on keeping on.
Thank you. I'll try. I'll say one last sentence, and it's absolutely true. You have to understand there's no such thing as an ex-Mormon. There's no such thing as a Mormon. It's all fake. It's all a combined illusion. And when you recognize that, what divides us and what makes us anger isn't really real. But that's a hard place to get to. I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's give them one more round.